Welcome to the Glasgow Short Film Festival 2021 podcast. I'm Sana Yahul, the festival's co-director, and on behalf of our entire team, thank you for listening. We are happy to present this GSFF podcast series as part of our 14th edition, taking place online from the 22nd to the 28th of March. The Strand Barbed Wire Love, Artists, Filmmakers and Their North of Ireland Troubles was initially put together for GSFF 20 by artist and filmmaker Myrit Carton and director of Berwick Film and Media Arts Festival, Peter Taylor. After postponing The Strand last year, we are pleased to now present a revised version, including a short film programme, three features, and a filmmaker conversation. To complement The Strand, this podcast episode is a discussion led by writer and curator Sarah Grivu with The Strand curators Peter and Myrit, as well as filmmakers Mariah Garnett, Desmond Bell, and Margot Harkin. You can find out about the Barbed Wire Love programme and schedule on the GSFF website and screening hub. Enjoy the episode.
So I'm Sarah Grivu, and I'm delighted to be asked here with such an amazing group of people. And thank you so much to Myrit and Peter for the invitation and to Glasgow Short Film Festival. I think we'll start with just a little round of introductions. So I'm the incoming curator of visual arts and Project Art Center in Dublin. But over the last couple of years, I've been working on and off on a project called It's Not For You, We Did It for the biennial EVA International, that looks at Derry Film and Video Project, which was a collective film production group that Margot Harkin belonged to, and along with whom she made Hushabye Baby. And I have an interest in the films that were made by Derry Film and Video Workshop, but also in the ways that they worked and organized themselves and in the broader kind of political context in which they were operating. So I guess as a way to build up a kind of alternative history of that era of the late 1980s and early 1990s in Derry, and maybe try to think about a genealogy of methods of cultural practice that we can draw on today. So that's like a brief introduction to me, and maybe we can start with Peter and Myrit, who can introduce themselves now.
Yeah, so I'm Peter Taylor. I'm a film curator and the director of Berwick Film and Media Arts Festival. I was very, very excited when Glasgow Short Film Festival asked myself and Myra to put together a program relating to the Troubles in Northern Ireland and around the time of their 50th anniversary of their commencement. And yeah, I'm 47. So it's pretty close to my whole life experience in a way. And I was born in Northern Ireland and in Belfast, but grew up mostly in Bangor, a seaside town beside Belfast. And then I left for the Netherlands in 99, just around the time of the ceasefires and peace agreement. Yeah, but I guess one of the starting points for the program and I guess one of my main interests generally is looking at media history and the history of cinema in a kind of revisionist way, really looking for the important things that maybe aren't so well told in mainstream cinema history, for want of a better word. Certainly people know the North of Ireland from the news and from Hollywood blockbusters and a lot of 80s pop songs as well, but I guess in a way we myself and Myrit really wanted to present the work of such as Margot and Derry Film and Video Workshop, who we're really investigating what it meant to tell stories that were meaningful for themselves rather than all these other power players or people that were telling the stories really for profit in a way and So that was that's starting point.
Thank you. Myrid?
Hello, everyone. My name is Myrid Carton, and I am a filmmaker and an artist who spent my teenage years in Derry and am now based between East Belfast and Donegal. I am working on a feature film in Donegal that looks at home and belonging and inheritance. So it felt really apt whenever I was working on this with Peter, this program. I had lived away in England for 5 years as well, and then also in the Republic of Ireland in Dublin. So I'd only been back probably in Northern Ireland for a short period of time whenever this opportunity to work with Peter and to work on this program came up. And it was really exciting to discover both new work and work that I hadn't been familiar with. And thinking about that, just and it was a very interesting moment because it was the year when sort of Milkman came out by Anna Burns and Say Nothing came out. Two brilliant books that I had read before this program started, and basically it made me reconsider all the stories that I didn't know about Northern Ireland. I was born in 91, and obviously I felt the residue of growing up in Derry and even just walking around East Belfast, but these helped me reconsider. And then these works added further to my understanding of what had gone on and the stories that we hadn't heard. So it's been a real pleasure and a privilege and really exciting to bring it to an audience at last. And hopefully me and Peter can talk a little bit more about the themes that that guided us in selecting the work, and in particular these three great films, which have many different approaches, but there's certain things about them that really made us feel energized about the program. So it'd be great to talk about them and let the filmmakers introduce themselves.
Maybe we can start with you, Des. Could you give us a brief just introduction to yourself, and we'll have a chance to talk more about the films themselves.
Yes, I was born in Derry, contemporary of Margot's in terms of that, but different sides of the city, I guess. Although various times, Derry's a very small place, so you tend to know people pretty intimately. I, like a lot of people my age, I left Derry, you know, in the end of the 60s and 70s to be educated in England, and then became an academic and kept on returning. I worked at the University of Ulster, and I worked at in Edinburgh for a while, teaching in the film school at Napier, and ended up my academic career running the academic side of the National College of Art and Design in Dublin. I combined my academic work with film, starting off very traditional portrayals of the loyalist community in Northern Ireland and problems with density associated with that. The last of that film in that series of films, which were largely supported by Channel 4, was the film that you screened in the festival, Dancing in Narrow Ground. After that, my practice changed a lot, and I started to work in predominantly found footage and archive films, and to actually work on Donegal stories. Everybody who lives in Derry has, Myrid knows, there's a very strong connection with Donegal. I have plenty of relatives there, friends who live there permanently. So I've crisscrossed back and forth. Now I find myself retired from academic life, which should give me a lot more time for filmmaking, but as everybody knows, finding the money in filmmaking is always the problem. So I'm writing actually more than I'm filmmaking at the moment. We're coming up to Northern Ireland at 100 years, and I'm working on a text with a former colleague from Queen's University in Belfast on that topic. And we are looking critically at Northern Ireland 100 years after its foundation, and possibly asking the question, is this the end of the beginning or the beginning of the end?
Thank you, Des, for that introduction. Can I ask you, Mariah, to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi, I'm Mariah Garnett, and I am an artist and a filmmaker. My connection to Northern Ireland is that my dad is from there. He was born in Belfast and raised in an area that was, it doesn't exist anymore. It was in West Belfast, but the motorway went in over his old neighborhood. So it was a loyalist street in a mixed community, but very working class mixed community that doesn't exist anymore. But I didn't know any of that until a couple of years ago. And yeah, my understanding of Northern Ireland basically came through Cranberry's songs in the 90s. I was born in 1980. So Northern Ireland was like on the periphery of my consciousness growing up in America. But, and I knew my dad was from there and I knew he was Protestant, but I had no idea what that meant. And like, until I got to Belfast, didn't fully believe that Irish Protestants existed. And so I spent a lot of time when I was making my film focused on loyalist communities. The film I made is called Trouble. And it took me around 5 years to make it. And it's basically just paralleling my own relationship with my estranged father. He's not estranged anymore. My developing relationship with my estranged father and the place that he grew up where he is estranged from, because he left in 1971 or 72 and hasn't seen or spoken to anyone there since, anybody in his family, any friends, anything. But I was surprised to discover while I was making it all of the civil rights history. That was something nobody in the States really hears about. And loyalist paramilitary is also something that nobody hears about in the States. So yeah, I was really struck by a lot of the parallels and the like intentional parallels between the Black civil rights movement here that was happening at the same time as the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland. And also just kind of like the resurgence of a new civil rights movement in the States happening while I was looking at the history of the Northern Irish civil rights movement. And it was all just because I was trying to get to know my dad.
Brilliant. Thank you. And Margot.
Yeah, as Dara said, we're of an age. I was born in 51, so it'll be not that's a very long time. Started probably in 1984 with Dairy Film Video Workshop. Before that, my background was in the arts field. I had been to art college in Belfast during the worst part of the Troubles. I mean, it really was the worst part, 70 to 74. And that was a very frustrating experience. I felt very alienated from it all and felt that, like, the Ulster Loyalist Worker Strike happened while I was there, and our final year exhibition was postponed. And I tried to go into the art college during the Ulster Loyalist Worker Strike when people were shutting down basically every place in Northern Ireland. But I went in to find, like, because I wasn't part of the strike. And the technician, who to this day I'll never forget him, he was to me the salt of the earth from a Protestant background who I got on very well with. And he literally physically threw me out of the building and said, "Who do you think you are?" I'll never forget it. And later he destroyed one of my works that had been kept. It's an honor to have one of your works kept and put in exhibition in the first year after you leave the college. And he, when I went to collect it, he had destroyed it, you know. So that was the kind of artistic climate I was working in. So when I got the opportunity, and I worked in the theater then, I worked with Field Day Theater Company, which just was an amazing experience for me. It started in 1980. And, you know, I was working with giants of the theatre and giants of the Irish, you know, intellectual world. Regrettably, mostly all male. But, you know, it was still the most incredibly stimulating time for me for the first time ever. And then this opportunity came up that Channel 4 had just started and was looking for, basically trying to seed a bed of talent throughout the UK, including Northern Ireland. And there were several groups in Northern Ireland that applied for funding. And a group of people, some people approached me, and basically Anne Crowley and Tricia Ziffin and myself set up the Dairy Film and Video Workshop. And around that time as well, there were, apart from the Troubles in Northern Ireland, that was in 1984, 1983 we had the abortion referendum in Ireland. And then we had the case of Anne Lovett. And we had the case of Joanne Hayes in 1984, where, you know, there was a tribunal into the fact that a baby had been found dead, stabbed and washed up on a beach in Granard, and down in the Republic of Ireland. In County Kerry, I should say. And she was accused of the murder. So there were all these cases that became cause celebre for women in Ireland who were fighting the unbelievable misogyny of Irish society at the time, you know, a country where there was no divorce, there were no gay rights, certainly no abortion. 1983 was the year in which they put it into the constitution that abortion was banned until it could be overturned again in a referendum. So these were extremely controversial times. It was described as the time the country was in a state of moral panic. And although we, as a subject matter, as themes, we came up with different ideas, that was my main one, was to do something about, you know, how women were treated in Ireland, about the issue of abortion in particular, but to do it in a way that, you know, I could reach people and not be polemical. So I've been a filmmaker since that time and basically have tried my best to chronicle the troubles. But as Des says, it's hard to get the films you want made.
Thank you, Margot. I mean, I feel like everybody in their introductions, they have just kind of naturally touched on the main thing that I'm interested in seeing these films collected together, which is the way all of these films sort of rub against and along the grain of our popular understanding or representations of the recent history of the conflict in the north of Ireland. And so I'm looking forward to speaking a little bit more about that with you all. But I would love to start. I'm always interested in the kind of nuts and bolts of things. And it's come up a few times, just even in the introductions, like money, for instance, or the kind of conditions of production. And I wonder if I could start by asking everybody to give a little bit of a background to the conditions of production of your work. So the funding, your methods, the way these things freed you to make certain decisions or imposed restrictions on the work that you made. And maybe Margot, you would maybe give us a bit of a outline on that.
Derry Film and Video appeared almost out of nowhere because it was really down to Channel 4, because there was no film board in Ireland at the time. It had been closed down because Burman, who was the chief executive, decided there were no Irish films worth making, which was an astounding notion for him to come up with in terms of, you know, trying how you grow a film industry in Ireland. Northern Irish Screen, as it's known now, didn't exist. I was one of the founders of the original organisation, and it took a long time to pull that together. But it's doing really well now, and I haven't had anything to do with it for years, but you know, it's always been very supportive of my work. So there was nothing really, you know, there were, the broadcasters were the only people who were really making films, apart from a few exceptions I can think of. But, you know, people like me couldn't get a job in the BBC. I wasn't trusted because of my particular political slant. I mean, I remember when we started making films, our work was incessantly referred to the regulatory body in the north. I can't even remember what it's called now. It's not Ofcom now, but it was something else then. And they were always told to watch out for what it was we were doing. You know, I mean, the person who was in charge of it at the time, who was David Dunseith, told us about that later, and he was very supportive of us, actually. So censorship was rife, I suppose, is the idea that I'm saying. So it was hard. Only Channel 4 came in and absolutely based its whole origins on this idea that there was a whole body of people out there who were not represented on the mainstream media. And that was a godsend to us. I mean, they probably had their suspicions about us as well, you know. I mean, I believe that the people in Belfast described us as the Chuckies, you know, because we were Republican. We were Chucky comes from a phrase called Chucky Our La, which means our day will come, and it was a slogan of the IRA at the time. And I just thought that was funny. You had to have a bloody sense of humour to deal with this situation. So we were defiant, but definitely we had a burning need to speak at the time. And if it hadn't been for Channel 4, there's no way we would have come into existence. And in fact, it took us years to get funding from Channel 4, absolutely years before we got properly funded. So, and I suppose those years with Channel 4, you know, we only made two films which were ever broadcast, and one of those was banned, and that was Mother Ireland. People were surprised then by Hushabye Baby, which was a drama which was exploring, it was interrogating ourselves, it wasn't a polemic. And so I think, you know, that began to give a bit of recognition in terms of, you know, there were people out there who had a right, who had something to say and had a right to say it. And although I've struggled down the years to make the things I want to make, you know, it was a calling card that enabled me to say, you know, please give me some funding to make these films, you know. So,
yeah, perfect. Thank you. Des, could I maybe ask you to speak to that as well? to the, I suppose, to speak about the funding or the frameworks or infrastructure that was in place when you were making Dancing on Narrow Ground.
I started out sort of filmmaking with the sort of working with my students in Dublin, and I managed to convince them to come up to the north to record loyalist marching activity of the sort that Mariah's film is full of. And then, like sort of Margot, you know, I was lucky and hooked up with Channel 4, who support two films. You know, I went from a budget of £900 for an entire sort of project, and putting up the students in my room and making their meals while taking them out to shoot the film, to then having, you know, large, well, in comparative terms, a large budget for two broadcast documentaries. And then, you know, we were all dependent on one particular inspired editor, Rod Stoneman, who worked for Channel 4, then subsequently was head of the Irish Film Board, then became, like myself, an academic. He was very, very supportive of all this work. But of course, he left Channel 4, and when he left, our favours in Channel 4 disappeared very rapidly. So Dancing in Our Ground was back again to the earlier model of filmmaking, working with technicians and students, which actually I very much enjoyed as an activity. It was made on a very small budget. There was a group called the Cultural Traditions Group, which was a community relations part of the Northern Ireland authorities at the time, and they provided money for the exploration of questions of identity, including youth identities. Now, the actual inspiration for the film, I suppose, was probably a film that was made 10 years earlier, which was John T. Davis's film, Shell Shock Rock, which traced the sort of development of punk music in Belfast and its capacity to transcend the sectarian divide. And I guess what I was trying to do was to see, taking John's idea, I knew John quite well from his filmmaking, take that idea and test it in a new context, which was just before the peace process broke out, some of the darkest times actually in many ways in Northern Ireland, and to see the rave culture that had broken out. Could it create a non-sectarian space for young people, as punk had done, you know, all those years earlier? But that was the auspices of the film. The film was made on an absolute shoestring. Channel 4 didn't support it, wouldn't broadcast it. BBC said there was far too much cursing and bad behaviour in it, so they wouldn't support it either. So the film sat on a shelf for years and years until Connell, my editor, took it off one day and put it on the web. And all of a sudden, Vice News were on to me, and they wanted to, you know, they had them vast numbers of hits. Coincided, I think, with anniversary of people hitting some 40 who'd been involved in hitting middle age, who'd been involved in rave culture, and getting nostalgia about this. And I remember the editor, the very young editor, Glaswegian, I think, of Vice, said to me, "I really like this. You know, it's it seems to have a story. You know, it seems to have people. It seems to be a reason. It seems to be politics involved in it." And I said, "Yes, it's called a documentary film," because this time, vast amounts of footage were being shown of ravers, but without any context and any filmic form. So, you know, it was really it was a challenge making the film on a very shoestring budget, but it was good to go back to those primitive, basic methods, you know, and not be encumbered by all the constraints of a broadcast contract.
That's super interesting that some of the funding was actually reconciliation funding in particular. I find that really fascinating. And maybe we can talk a little bit more about that, but maybe we can go to Mariah and you can speak a little bit about how your film was made. I know that you worked on a different kind of a time scale, maybe to what somebody making a film for broadcast would work on. And maybe you can speak a little bit about that.
So, yeah, I should have mentioned this in my introduction, but I come from more of a visual arts background, and I'm an artist who makes films that show mostly in galleries and institutions. And I don't really have much of a toehold in the like traditional broadcast or independent film funding structures. So the way I made this was kind of like making an art piece. And actually the first iteration of it was exhibited as a video installation. But I funded it in small emerging artist grants in about $10,000 chunks over the course of 5 years. So I was sort of lucky to have been hitting a particular moment in my career as an artist where I was getting recognized as an emerging artist, probably like five, six years out of grad school. And over the course of the first couple of years that I started working on Trouble, I just kept getting emerging artist grants. So that enabled me to like start going. And it enabled me to leave America for a year. And, you know, I mean, I wasn't paying rent, so I was bouncing around from residency to residency. And I don't know, it was like very scotch taped together finance plan. But yeah, I mean, it made it difficult because I had to just sort of shoot it maybe 10 minutes at a time. But it also enabled me to spend a lot more time in Northern Ireland and like see how rapidly things change there while also staying exactly the same. Like every time I go back to Belfast, like some place would have closed or someone would have moved away, or I just found it really hard to keep up there, strangely. You know, being from like a major metropolitan area, I was like, there's too much for me to do every time I got to Belfast. Yeah, it was just, I guess, I personally funded, I guess, through small unrestricted artist grants that I basically just put all back into the film.
I think it's super interesting that you work somewhere at that border between art practice and a gallery-based practice. And I wonder if that might have had an impact in terms of the audience that you were imagining. And I'd love to take that back to Margot and Des afterwards, but I'd love to hear from you. I feel, Des, you sort of touched on this as well, that you had maybe a particular audience that you had in mind in the beginning. And then you, when the film went up on YouTube, you gained a completely different audience, maybe from what you had imagined in the first place. But Mariah, maybe I could ask you just to continue on with talking about that practice and like who did you, when you started making the film, who were you picturing as your audience, and did that shift over time?
Yeah, I mean, I think my goal was always to make a feature length film, and it actually like didn't change that much over the course of the 5 years as I was making it. How, you know, I pictured it being like these parallel investigations of my relationship with my father and the place where I'm have roots, but I'm not from, which is Belfast. So it actually kind of like turned out the way that I had planned, but I didn't have a set route there, I guess is the answer for that. I think I was really concerned about audiences. I wanted it to speak to, I knew it wouldn't speak equally to audiences in Northern Ireland and America, but I wanted it to be legible to Americans and have some resonance in Northern Ireland beyond just like, here's a picture of Northern Ireland, like every other one you've ever seen by someone from outside who comes and makes a movie about Northern Ireland. I think just the way I generally think about audiences is I try to be as accessible as possible and then just show it where whoever will have me. So I don't necessarily try to draw a distinction between visual art audiences and a sort of wider spread, more mainstream audience. I will say, though, I was not imagining an online audience when I was making this, and it's been kind of difficult for me over the last, I mean, it came out in like the end of 2019. So most of its life has been online. This was supposed to happen in person a year ago, and I was really looking forward to this one. But it's a totally different experience watching it with a live audience. I would imagine than watching it alone on your laptop. So that is something that, I do think about is like what happens in a room when people are collectively watching something that's like not exactly following a standard movie format. Like it doesn't really adhere to any genre conventions. And I think that there's this sort of like tacit agreement that an audience makes to like stick it out and see what happens that does not happen when you're on a laptop. So I'm pleased that it's had a life in COVID, but this is not my ideal viewing format for sure.
But Margot, what about yourself? I mean, I know the film was made for Channel 4, but I feel like what I discern in the film is that you are speaking to a local audience, as well as speaking out about what was happening at the time in Derry.
To be perfectly honest, it was made very much for within Ireland. I mean, that's what where the change was required. I wasn't really thinking of people in Britain at all, because they had a whole different set of rules in terms of the themes I was discussing. So it was addressing these issues that had come up, these pretty striking, controversial issues. And I'm talking about Hush My Baby just now. I'm not necessarily talking about anything else, but I suppose it applied to, I think when we were doing more political stuff about what was going on, you know, when the politics of Northern Ireland, that was addressing an English audience. We're saying, look, this is going on here and you've no bloody clue about it. You know, we'd like you to listen to us. But in terms of Hush My Baby, I was talking within the Irish state, and not just within the Irish state. Northern Ireland had much the same set of circumstances. I mean, to this day, Northern Ireland lags behind in terms of abortion rights. So yeah, I was absolutely trying to talk to people within Ireland, and I was saying to them, I know you know this young girl. I mean, my story was very simple. It didn't take the controversial stories, I just referred to them. But I wanted them to recognize who Gretty was, you know, that she was somebody that I knew that everybody knew somebody like her, because I'd done a lot of research, and everybody that we spoke to, no matter where we went, and even when we were around the film, people were coming to me afterwards. I mean, it was just extraordinary, the feeling that we got out of it, that people said, you've spoken for me, you know, for the first time. So we were speaking to the population within Ireland and saying to people, you know, this girl, you might even know her in your family. You might be around, you might be her mother, you might be her father. I want you to think yourself into her position, you know, and how should we address this?
Absolutely. Des, do you want to speak to that question about the audience that you were imagining and possibly the kind of afterlife of the film and a different audience that it found?
Yeah, well, that's one of the interesting things about films. They do have different afterlives, and you know, we all like, my practice changed to archival footage. So I spent a hell of a long time looking at the various earliest of films from the 1890s up to, you know, the 1920s. And, you know, we constantly rediscover this treasure trove. But it was a tremendous pleasure for me for people to go back to this film and to enjoy it in a different sort of way. People don't necessarily online watch an entire film. They won't watch a bit of it, and then they might come back, particularly a film that attracts, you know, a rave audience. Because the films that you make when you have a broadcast contract are, I guess, geared towards broadcast conventions. You may be trying to slightly shift these, but your commissioning editor is always going to bring you back to questions of coherence, intelligibility, broadcast conventions. But it was good to get away from some of that stuff, I found, and also to get away from, you know, the sort of constraints that you couldn't have working class kids cursing and swearing and behaving badly. It's different now. BBC wouldn't, Northern Ireland wouldn't be worried about that sort of thing, but at that time they were, you know, and they actually would have stopped all that. And the idea that, you know, that these type of young people who normally never portrayed, you know, on television in a documentary mode, they didn't get a chance to speak to camera. That was very important for me too. I mean, I'd done quite a lot of anthropological research on youth culture, interviewing people long before the film was made. So it was really a chance to give people, and they were intensely interested. The screens that did take place were with amongst groups of young people, almost like in the youth club settings, precisely because the broadcast possibility had gone. So, you know, the film, you know, played in visual anthropology festivals, it played in a few film festivals, it played when people were interested in youth cultural issues, when youth workers would organize and show it to school kids. And, you know, but then when it went sort of viral, it got a completely different audience, people in Germany, people in America, who were all interested in rave culture. But then through that particular initial interest, then were drawn into understanding the politics of Northern Ireland, something which they didn't know about. And of course, the simplicity of the story initially, i.e. it's about getting across the sectarian divide, it is slowly but surely undermined within the film, and you're led to believe it's all much more complex than that simple narrative, you know, that, you know, rave culture in itself couldn't do this. You know, it required a political momentum to do. And that was what was the tragedy of the film, of these young people, was that they were ready for change, but the politicians weren't.
That's so interesting, because I had another question that was about that kind of binary framework. And if that's that, even within an idea of creating dialogue within that framework, if that placed some limitations maybe on how you were working. But I guess I was reading this maybe against Trouble, which was made in a different era, of course, where there are different possibilities for how we can find the stories that cut across that divide. And the way Hushabye Baby, it didn't really attempt to create an idea of balance. It wasn't concerned with like the two sides of the story in a in terms of like a narrative framework that has been privileged so much in representations of here. And it made me think, I mean, I think it's very clear in Dancing on Narrow Ground that you're trying to hold space for young people to narrate their own experiences in a way. But it made me think, also speaking with Myrid, about this idea of the voice and like things that are left unsaid or like failed communications that run through all of the films in a way. And I wonder, maybe Mariah, you could speak to that a little bit. Like, I find your it's not a voiceover, but it's like a written kind of a voiceover that deals so much with these like missed connections or failed communications. And I find that super interesting.
Yeah, failed communication. I don't know. That was sort of like the main thing in the film, I think. I have like a log line that I say that nobody ever, it's not a good log line for selling the film or anything, but that it's a failed movie about a failed relationship set against the backdrop of a failed revolution. And, you know, in those failures, there's like something else that happens. And that's like where life actually is like not achieving the goal. And then something over here happens. And that's what I want to look at, is the thing that over there happens.
Comes through queerness as well, doesn't it? I mean, there's an idea that association with queerness and failure, in a productive sense, like that failure can be a way to reach something else somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. There's like, I mean, Jose Munoz has this whole essay on queer failure and how it's, you know, it's like the failure at being heterosexual, basically, or the failure at, you know, being a Stepford wife looking woman, that like those failures become our strengths in a way. I think that that's true in Northern Ireland too, the sort of queer failure paradigm, that like there's this binary that's impossible to uphold. It's a violent one too, and everybody's like under the threat of this, of I guess retribution, repercussions of violence for failing to live up to the binary standard that's set in place there. So yeah, I like to think of it as kind of a queer place that's like impossible. There's a standard that's impossible to live up to. That's like this abstract political concept, and people's lives are built off of like navigating their ways around that impossibility. And that's what I was really interested in, generally speaking, in Northern Ireland. And I definitely wanted to like put my naivete up front. I felt like in that way I could actually like reach audiences in multiple places, because like American audiences needed the basic information. But I was at the same time trying to present that information with like, and this is my naive outsider perspective. Whereas like it's completely different once you get here.
Margot, maybe you could speak to how you cut across that binary using gender or using, you know, other ways of like understanding the politics of that moment in Hushabye Baby.
Can I just first say that I absolutely loved your film, Mariah. I just thought, God, what a fresh way to look at this. And I just loved everything about it. I loved, you know, the fact that you inhabited your father because he wouldn't come over. And this, there was a great sadness to it, but also great bravery, you know, in terms of you coming here. And as you say, using your naivete, I recognize many things in terms of, you know, the way people God, they all wanted you to listen to them and to take a part in your film. I mean, that happens all the time and it can be very annoying. But you were so good the way you dealt with people. And I just could not have imagined that take on Northern Ireland. And it was so revealing. It just, your outsider eye just showed a whole kind of set of images of desolation and loneliness and sadness and lack of movement. You know, it was terrific. I just have to say that. So I just loved it so much. And I actually can't wait to watch it again. So, yeah, okay. Yeah. No, you see, words like binary are not words that I'm used to, Sarah. What is it that you want me to talk about? Because I'm not really into this kind of, I'm not generally, you know, this is a whole new set of conversational frameworks that's happened since I made that film. So mine was obviously very hetero in terms of, you know, I was really interested in the whole issue of women's reproductive rights and who had control over them. That was my primary thing. And that young women should not be forced, you know, by the powers that be to be reproductive basically reproductive just cases, really. That's what they were. And it produced a great deal of anger in me and lots of women I knew, and still does. I mean, I just become absolutely incandescent with rage when I think about what people are trying to do to women on this island and all over the world. In terms of how, well, I suppose the research that I did on it was very genuine. Like, we did a workshop called No Sex, Please, We're Irish, which was based on a play that was running in the West End a lot at the time. And we had lots of young people come together to talk about that. I didn't go out of my way to get a Protestant viewpoint. I did to an extent. I went to the two bishops in the area, the Catholic bishop and the Protestant bishop. And of course, the Protestant bishop, Bishop Mahaffey, who's dead now, was much more liberal in terms of how he approached the subject. I mean, for a start, they accepted marriage within their organization. And we also went and spoke to people who had been through this experience, and we did it privately. We kept their names private. Like, some people in the workshop didn't know who we were talking to. I think I was particularly involved with the Irish Catholic experience, because that was the experience that was controlling women mostly in Ireland at the time. And in terms of the male, I mean, I did write a sympathetic character, but that character, played by Michael Liebman, of Gretti's boyfriend, gave me probably the most angst in the film. That and the British soldier, who was painted a wee bit sympathetically as well. But the letter that he had to write to her from prison at the end was actually the hardest thing in the whole film to write. I did so many versions of that and was close to tears. It meant that much to me, you know, how I presented these arguments. Even after I felt I'd done a very sympathetic portrayal of him. I was attacked by people. I was attacked by people for all sorts of things in the film, but people said I gave him a bit of a kick in the teeth. I didn't think I did. I thought I was very sympathetic to him. So, yeah, you were challenging, you know, the ways you were supposed to behave and the ways that you were supposed to hold secrets and the ways you were supposed to hold the line. You know, it was definitely reducing that to an extent and crossing those barriers.
And it's complexified because you're not just dealing with gender. You're not just dealing with the political context. You're finding the places where those things like rub against each other and create like the friction. And you're dealing in a very sensitive way with those kind of points of friction, I think.
Well, thank you. But it's probably easier for you to comment on that than me. Yeah, I mean, I think it has lots of subtleties. I mean, every scene has a subtlety. Like that little scene where Gretti and her boyfriend are walking after they've started dating, and she asks them to translate with the soldiers. They come up against a soldier patrol, and he speaks Irish, you know. And I got a lot of criticism for that, you know. Why the fuck got a British partner or a soldier speak Irish? And again, that was based on, you know, research which allowed us to do that actually special branch at least were taking Irish classes at the time so that they could help them understand what Republicans who were lifted, you know, how they spoke about in coded conversations in their own language, in Irish language. it was a bit of a stretch, but nevertheless, it was based on reality. And, you know, he behaves like a little macho shit, like he knows better. So, and I have them walking past this mural. I mean, people don't think you construct dramas. They don't think you construct the images. I mean, I've had people say extraordinary things to me in terms of what they believed I was doing. But, I mean, that was very absolutely, definitely constructed, where they walked past a mural which said, "Many have eyes but cannot see." You know, so she is subservient in that particular position, but I'm digging at him as well, you know, in terms of how he thinks about things. And there were many letters to the paper, let me tell you, who were very critical of the film. Some of them were hilarious. And then the following week, then people wrote in support of the film, you know, so it really did feed into the community. Like, everybody was talking about it, so it had an impact.
This is it. It's like people are invested in it enough that they are like, yeah, amazing. Des, do you want to speak to that a little bit? Just about that, like trying to find a way to work through that binary or work through that idea of presenting the two sides.
It became within broadcast television, British broadcast television, such a set of cliches, the sub search. I mean, in fact, interesting in Mariah's film is that the film that her father is caught up in is precisely embodies this attempt to reduce, to drive the politics out and to deal with, you know, a love relationship across the sectarian divide as a sort of theme. And I was always very unhappy about that, because my starting point has been to try and understand loyalism and trying to not because I've, I mean, it's neither my background, although I'm of Protestant origin, it's neither my background nor is anything I have the slightest sympathy with. But I always thought there was an obligation upon somebody like myself who had the tools of critical and creative, you know, available to them to try and tell that particular story and to tell it as well as possible and to allow young loyalists to tell the story. That was the essential thing for me. Now, the weakness of my film, and Margot, I think, has identified the opposite. The weakness of my film is that when we tried to work with the young Catholic ravers in West Belfast, two groups, Protestant East Belfast, a group, Catholic, well, but was West Belfast, another group, the tension was, and this was the sort of the parody of the old broadcast thing, get them together and love across the divide. You know, it didn't happen, which was great. I'm not even sure if I ever wanted it to happen, but certainly it didn't happen. And of course, the story is how it didn't happen. The real moment of truth in the film occurs, well, there's two moments of truth. The first one occurs in West Belfast, just on the eve of the peace process, where, you know, the young people sense turn on me, still quite good-naturedly, around a bonfire all drinking, and they say, "You can go across to East Belfast. You can sit with us in West Belfast. You can go with Emmons because you're, you know, you're a Jaffa, you're an Orange man, you know, but we can't go there. It's about power." And that was the essential. Second one was when the young, incredibly reflective young woman, father had been a loyalist paramilitary, you know, comes to an extraordinary self-understanding about the limitations of Protestant identity, which I think, I mean, I hate to blow the film up, but that seems to me one of the few moments ever in British broadcasting that sort of self-reflection has really been allowed to surface. And I just find it incredibly moving the way that she struggles with that and comes to an honest assessment of the sort that the rest of a political community have been unable to for 50 years. And those two points about power and about honest self-reflection were, what, for me, were what the essence of the film was. And you know, all the other trappings of the rave culture, the people trying to get across the sectarian divide, were secondary to those two moments, you know, which I think were revealing. You know, I'm very proud of those.
Great. Yes, thank you. I don't know how to put in the inverted commas around both sides in my question. Those should have been represented somehow. That's terrific. Super interesting. I'm wondering, Myrid and Peter, I have more questions, but maybe some of what has come up so far, maybe you'd like to speak to that in terms of how these three feature films fit into the larger program that you built for the film festival. And maybe some of the threads that we've talked about here, how those maybe ran through your thinking or brought up things for you around that.
I just want to say this talk has been great. It's been so amazing to hear about how the films have been made. And for me, I didn't know so much about, I knew with Mariah's film, but with Des's, and I knew from Des's film, but not the extent of it. And then with Margot's film, I felt on watching them that they were incredibly humane films. And now you haven't heard that all three of you have had this method of like embedded research, of doing workshops, of, you know, being present with people, of living in the area. Like, I think that that is what has made the film so rich. And for us, one of the things that we were looking for across the whole program was that there was a range of both humor and pathos shown in people, and that there was no sensationalism or judgment or moralizing. And so I think you've done a great job of not making it polemic, as you said. And for me, what was really, in these three films in particular, what really spoke across the strand, we were interested in relationships and domestic and social spaces and everyday lived experiences of living next to something and the sort of porous atmosphere of that, but that not being the driving focus. But in these three films in particular, for me, it was really, what was really striking about all of them was the focus on the young and their vitality and hope and desire for something and beyond the troubles, be that love, progressive politics or dancing. But that the films, as Sarah has said, like really shows these moments when this young idealism kind of rubs up against the reality of the social structures that they find themselves in. But what is so amazing is that even though it's this attempt for individuals to sort of gain freedom and autonomy in the midst of like the cultural baggage, it's never as I said, binary or the individual against the social. There's always a kind of attempt or a recognition of a belonging and this complication between both belonging to and being part of and wanting to change society and move forward, but also how that impinges on our sort of, I suppose, autonomy. And that's why it makes it so rich for a viewer. And I think that's really come up in the conversation, which has been incredible. And hopefully people will use all watch the short films as well and see how that has informed our decision with those too.
Maybe I could just finish up with a final question for everybody to ask people to reflect on these films within their own practice. For the older two films in particular, but really for all of them, like, what are the things that continue to resonate or return in your work? And maybe actually, Mariah, you could speak to that and speak about maybe like what were the precursors, or how does Trouble relate to the other work that you have made, and what connections can you draw for us?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like a culmination of every other film I made before it, kind of, mixed together and set in Northern Ireland. But most of my films are sort of experimental documentaries, and they're all about just me creating a relationship to the person on screen. So it's never really like a direct documentary about another person's experience. It's about like creating a relationship that then gets sort of like dissected over the course of the film. So I'll usually start with like a projection onto someone else, like an idea of what the other person is. And then I sort of chip away at it and change it over the course of the film, and then it turns into something else. And it's always someone I don't really know very well. My dad fit the mold of like the stranger who I had ideas and fantasies about that may not have had anything to do with who he actually was. And Northern Ireland also fit that mold. You know, the stakes are a little bit higher with this one because with, you know, previous people that I'd worked with, it was like, I've never wanted to like not have a relationship with someone after the end of the film or like have them hate me or something. But it wasn't as consequential to my life if that is how it turned out. this one, it was a lot more, it was a more intense process, I think, like walking that line of like being honest, but also wanting to represent someone in a good light and want to continue a relationship with them both my dad and Northern Ireland, actually, because I think the big thing that came out of this film for me was not only a relationship with my dad, but like a relationship with this place. Like, that's what really surprised me the most, I think, was just like how connected I felt to Belfast and how many strong relationships I made there and like how much I'm dying to go back. And yeah, getting like strangely emotional talking about it, actually. But that was the big surprise for me.
I mean, I had the pleasure of speaking to you during the making of this film at various points as you were coming over. And I feel like the ethics of that, like the ethics that you're speaking about, both the interpersonal ethics and a kind of political ethics, that really, it comes through in the film. It's very apparent that you were thinking in that way. Des, maybe we'll come back to you. Are there things in that film, you've spoken a little bit to this already, but are there things in the film that have continued to be themes or ideas or interests that have continued to work on you, or that you've continued to kind of worry at in your subsequent kind of practice?
I think we all bear the stigmata of having been brought up in the north of Ireland. That will always impact on our film practice. I mean, in my case, I was, uneasy with the whole question of representation. Although I think I did a reasonably good job at freeing people to speak who wouldn't otherwise have a chance, I still was worried by the sense I was speaking for people who couldn't articulate. The problem of loyalism has always been it's difficulty in articulating its political position and gaining the sympathy of anybody other than the inner circle of loyalists themselves. So after that, I actually started working with archive footage and with actors, because I found that considerably less ethically problematic. And it's not that those ethical challenges aren't worthwhile. They are, and I think that is the price you pay in documentary. You have to be prepared to wrestle with that, those ethical challenges. But I sort of felt that I needed to, I started working in a film school. I was a self-taught filmmaker, as I think the people in the Margo's crew in Derry were as well. I didn't have any sophistication, of the sort that you are bringing to bear, on critical language. I wasn't a film scholar even at the time. I was a sociologist. So only when I started to run the film school and work in the film school and come across, people who were doing artwork, photography, different sorts of practices, that I started to totally reformulate how I understood film. I had a very primitive sense of what filmmaking was. That was the excitement of it. I mean, you were plunged into the political situation. You made films without knowing what you were doing. But when you then got out of that immediate situation, I went to Edinburgh to work in Scotland, I was able to totally reevaluate from an aesthetic point of view and a critical point of view what I was doing. And then I made a couple of films which were very successful, much more successful than the earlier films, much better made in technical terms. The old narratives, the old concerns remain there. They don't go away. So yeah, I mean, you take your issues forward, but you look for different means of expression, different ways of, of developing your filmmaking expertise and insight. And then you probably will circle back again. I'd love to make a film now again about loyalism. But BBC, just like BBC won't touch Margot, they won't touch me either. They don't want to hear what we have to say, because there only is one position at the moment, which is based on the 1998 agreement. And that sets the terms of discourse of what can be said and what cannot be said. And the BBC is heavily invested in this.
The documentary, or the film I'm making at the minute, is a documentary, a feature documentary about the mother and baby homes in Ireland. And so that just shows you that I'm still, there's plenty of stuff there in terms of, what needs addressed in Ireland, in terms of subject material. It's another feature documentary, and it'll take a while to make. But so many scandals, so many abuses of women, and I'll be dead before it's ever even touched upon properly.
Thank you so much, everybody, for this conversation. It's been amazing to get so much detail about how you worked and what you were thinking. And I feel so grateful to be part of this conversation. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Before we finish, a few shout outs. Glasgow Short Film Festival is made possible thanks to the generous support of Screen Scotland and Film Hub Scotland. This podcast was produced for us by Helena Rifai, with music by Lewis den Hertog. We'd love to hear your responses to this episode and our festival program, so get in touch. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Glasgow Short. Enjoy the festival.